Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to now welcome Peter Krause. He is the owner of Ursus Rare Books. He's one of the world's leading antiquarian book dealers, and a part of his collection, Great Books on Opera and Music, will be at Garcia Street starting on July 3rd. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So how did you become an antiquarian book dealer?
Well, I was fortunate enough to have an uncle who was the world's leading antiquarian bookseller for the most of the 50s, 60s, and 70s and 80s, like for about a 40-year period. And so I got, you know, I watched what he did and then asked if I could go and work with him, and I did work with him for almost a decade, and then I decided I'd like to have my own shop. So set up on my own after 10 years of very serious apprenticeship.
Which I'm sure is by far the best way to do it, because you, as a child, you develop kind of an instinct for these things when you're around them all the time, I would think.
Well, also I had the immense good fortune to work with the kind of treasures you only get to see if you're in the library, because during the time that I was working there, we had the Gutenberg Bible in stock, which is nobody's ever had in stock in the book trade. We had the Audubon folio, the Shakespeare folios. It was a wealth of treasures that are unimaginable, and I could sort of handle them on a daily basis. So that kind of experience really is unique.
I don't think I would ever imagine hearing the sentence, "We had the Gutenberg Bible in stock."
Yeah, well, we did, and it's now in the University of Texas.
Amazing. Who are the clients for works of that caliber? Is it always universities and research facilities?
It sort of varies. I mean, it's funny. There was a time in the 60s where the collectors felt so under siege that there were wailings and gnashing of teeth that, collectors are being driven out of the market because places like Texas and the Lilly Library in Indiana and Yale and Harvard had so much money that the prices became so high that collectors sort of weren't able to compete. Well, now, of course, the pendulum has swung, and most institutions are hard put to buy very much at all, and so you're relying mostly on collectors. On the other hand, the thing that's changed since those days of the 60s is that you really have a global marketplace. You can sell a book to a Russian, to a Chilean, to somebody in New Zealand. I mean, there is, you know, I would say you can, even Africa, I mean, there, believe it or not, in South Africa, there are a couple of, you know, major, major world-class collectors. So the world has opened up, and that's a real problem because the supply is really unable to keep up with the demand, especially on the very high level, which is paradoxical because of the great, great things. You'll always find somebody who wants them, and they just aren't. There's just almost no supply at all.
What is the nature of a book collector? I mean, I've met many art collectors, and there is a kind of obsessiveness to that activity. And then you put these works on your walls, or sometimes you can't fit all of them on your walls, but you look at them every day. Book collection is a whole different thing. What is the nature of the relationship between the collector and those objects?
Well, I think it's much more in the mind. I mean, the thing is that, and in fact, Stefan Zweig wrote a famous story about that, but the idea that, you know, you sort of know you have them. Once you have them on the shelf, it's more, you know, you don't really need to see it. But unlike, there is paradoxically the other side to it, which is that unlike a picture, but more like a sculpture, they're very tactile. So that, not necessarily modern first edition of 20th century book isn't very tactile, but if you talk about books from the 15th to the 19th century, they're physical objects. And so the paper, the binding, handling them is actually a very significant part of the pleasure of bibliophily. But there's a kind of a potential philatelic possibility. Let's say you collect an author, or in this case, you know, we have this opera collection where the person tried to get all the great first editions of all the great operas, so that you're actually sort of, you have a goal, you're pursuing something, and there is a sort of finite end almost. I mean, it's never finite because there's always something you're missing, but you can actually sort of set out to pursue things, unlike, so if you're a painting collector, it's a rather wide thing. But the other thing is, of course, it is private. There are many book collectors. You can walk into their apartments or their houses and not know they're book collectors. That's very rarely the case with an art collector, where you walk into where they live and you're confronted with a Degas bronze or a Manet or, you know, used to Pollock. You see the art. It's more publicly displayed. But, you know, that's not to say, I mean, the book collector is some kind of introverted person hiding in their study, poring over their treasures, is a caricature, and it doesn't match up to reality. I mean, book collectors are a gregarious bunch. They like to discuss their books and show them to people and have them handled. I mean, I think a lot of people don't understand how important the handling of books it actually is.
What about the reading of books? Do book collectors actually tend to read the books that they collect?
I would say no, because, you know, they don't. By and large, they don't. But, you know, there are plenty of books that you can get a lot of, like illustrated books, which is one of our specialties. You don't need to read them. You flick through the pages and you look at them. It's a visual rather than a literal thing. But I think if you had a first edition of Ulysses, you'd probably rather read the current version than sit with your first edition. But you can do it. I mean, it's not to say that people don't read their books, but I think they read different versions than the ones they actually own.
I would think that, I mean, I have paperbacks that I had when I was a child, and they're already so deteriorated that if you open them, they fall apart. The books that that you're talking about that are many hundreds of years old, some of them, or even just a 100 or 200 years old, and we'll talk about the opera collection in a little while, how have they survived as well as they have? Has the paper just often better quality?
Yes, that's the thing. You see, up until the Industrial Revolution, the paper was almost indestructible because it tended to be made from rags, it was a natural product, or from tree, from wood. But the minute the Industrial Revolution came along and they started to use chemicals and mass-produce paper in the 19th century, you get these really catastrophic books that are printed on very cheap paper that had high chemical content, and they either completely fall apart or they go brown, and it's a catastrophe. So ironically, the early books tend to be, I mean, they've not survived for other reasons. I mean, you had endless situations in wars where they decided that the books are more useful as gun wadding to recycle the paper because they didn't have any more, so they used the books to make new paper. But they didn't tend to sort of fall apart and deteriorate the way that the books of the last 22 centuries have. And that's a paradox that people aren't always aware of, that, you know, the old books tend to be, you know, really built like a castle, whereas the modern books are sort of a disposable object. And paperbacks are a classic case. I mean, they literally fall apart while you're handling them.
And at the same time, far more people have access to them than they did when the books were indestructible.
Right. I mean, the thing that's also very different is up until the Industrial Revolution, sort of the time of Jane Austen, the book was for the very privileged. Most people couldn't read, and even if they could read, they couldn't afford to own a book. So the books are printed in tiny quantities, The reason that books haven't survived from the early periods is usually because most of them came from Europe, and Europe up until very recently was riven with war all the time. So the books were bombed, shelled, towns were laid waste, and that's what did the books in. The books were, if they minded their own business in a house, they survived. But they tended, in the country, but the books tended to be in urban places, and it was the places that housed the books that got destroyed, and the books along with them, more than the books sort of just disintegrating on their own.
When people are book collectors, do they tend to have special rooms and climate control and things like that?
Climate control is always a good idea. Special rooms, not necessarily. I mean, it's nice to have a library and a room where you have your books, but it's not a prerequisite. I mean, many do. I mean, there are many quite a few collectors that I know today that build purpose, you know, actual library buildings on their property for their books and control, you know, when they have a lot of money invested in their books, they want to have them properly looked after. So the climate is important. But ironically, it's another one of those greatly misunderstood things, because people often say, oh my, you know, how do you look after books? Surely they must deteriorate, blah, blah, blah. And it actually, I say to them, it's very simple. If you're happy, the book is happy. And the thing is, the kind of, you know, the book requires a kind of steady, normal temperature that the average human being feels comfortable. If it's madly hot or madly cold or madly damp or madly dry, the book's going to be unhappy just the way you'd be unhappy. So it needs to be in a kind of balanced environment. And it's not incredibly difficult to maintain that, although in many cases that it hasn't been done, especially if the book's in a tropical climate or, you know, somewhere, you know, where human beings shouldn't be in the first place.
Well, I mean, I've seen books with leather covers that have mold growing on them.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's from the damp. I mean, but anything else would have mold growing on it too. It's not the book that's attracting the mold, as the you know, just the natural, the environment's creating the mold.
We're talking to Peter Kraus. He's the owner of Ursus Rare Books, and we're actually here to talk about this collection, Great Books on Opera and Music, that is being shown, or part of it is being shown at Garcia Street Books, starting on Friday the 3rd of July. Tell us about this collection. Somebody wanted to collect all these books on the great operas.
Right. The opera collection is a collection. There is going to be a separate group of books that are individually for sale and separate from this, and they contain opera and music. But the opera collection was put together by a collector in New York over a lifetime, and what's exciting about it is it literally can't be done again, because, you know, we like to think all rare books are rare, that's why they're called rare books, but opera, music, and opera in particular, happened to be excruciatingly rare because they were printed. They were purpose-built. They were made for use. They were printed for a tiny little group of people who were going to be using these scores between the time the composer actually wrote the opera and it was then performed with a full orchestra in an opera house. Because, you know, if you think about it logically, when an opera is composed, the first thing isn't to sit around with an orchestra and play the opera, because it doesn't work like that. You have the music, you get it sung, and then once that all works, then you go to the next stage of having the orchestra come in and do the whole thing. So these were printed in tiny editions, and they were used by the singers, the conductors, the people who were and the musicians, and they were literally used to bits. So unlike most books where if you want to find even a Shakespeare folio, they've come up, even a Gutenberg Bible, there have been a couple for sale in the last 30 or 40 years. These operas have either not been no copies for sale, in some cases one copy for sale or two copies, but they just don't appear on the marketplace. And it's clear that it's not a collecting field the way, say, modern first editions and people collect The Hobbit or Harry Potter, or even The Great Gatsby, or they collect History of Science. But, I mean, it's not a very obvious collecting field, but there are great collections like the Morgan Library. But part of the reason that it's not an obvious collecting field is that there isn't the material. It's not that there's no supply. And this is why this is exciting to have this collection, because it was put together. But if you called me up and said, Peter, could you put me together a collection like this, I'd have to say, well, regardless of how much money you're willing to spend, it's probably not possible. It might, you know, in the next 15, 20 years, I might be able to do it, but it would be irresponsible of me to say that I could do it.
So when did this collector, can you say who it is, and when did they...
No, he doesn't want his name handed about.
When was he doing it? And how was it possible for him to do it at that time?
He was lucky that at one point in the 60s, there was an Italian collector whose collection came up for sale in some small some town in Italy that he heard about. So he went and he bought a clump. So he started with a clump and over a long period of time was able to sort of add to it. you know, one here, one there. So, but that, I think without having the initial, you know, 30 or 40 books, it probably wouldn't have been worth even starting. But that gave him the impetus.
And so, I guess when you think about which operas you want to collect, it's the kind of things that you would hear at the Santa Fe Opera and hear at the Met.
Exactly. It's the standard repertory. I mean, clearly, you know, you could say, well, there are lots of operas. But in actual fact, even if you took all of operas, a relatively small art form, there are not thousands of operas. There are probably a few hundred. And when you refine it down to the standard repertory, which was the goal this collector decided to get the operas that were formed in the great opera houses of the world, and he managed to get them in almost all of them. It's not complete. There are one that, you know, you can definitely point to the odd lacuna, but by and large, he's got from Gluck right up to the present. He's got pretty much everything. So it's it's only 85 operas, but so you can see it's not we're not talking about a vast thing.
Did the singers and conductors mark them up?
Yes, sometimes they did. Some, not always, but some of them. Most of these come from, you know, there's a stamp on that says who it came from, where it's signed, and you can see it came from, I mean, not all of them, but a large quantity of them came from people. I mean, I think the most notable previous owner is probably Richard Bonning and Joan Sutherland, of the sort of modern owners. But yeah, they did tend to make notes in them. But not on a track. It's not like you look at them and you think, oh, my God, this is a really ugly, they wrecked the book. They're, it's not that at all. But you can see that they've been used by somebody professionally.
Well, I mean, I think it could possibly be interesting from a scholarly point of view to see how this conductor or singer used it.
Absolutely.
So are these opera objects, are they books? I mean, what do they look like?
They are books. They tend to be mostly oblong in format, not vertical like the kind of books you read, because the need to put the music in have enough of a piece to see. Many of them have a picture. Often on the title page there'll be an image of, you know, taken from the opera, but they're not. They tend not to be illustrated. They have a kind. I happen to be a huge opera fan, and I think to hold one of these things in one's hand and realize that what you're holding is the opera in the form that it was before anybody knew it was what it was. I mean, you know, it was the magic flute was never heard in full performance at the time that this object was printed. So you're hearing, you're seeing, you're holding this object that takes you right back to the genesis. Obviously, it's not the manuscript; it's not in Mozart's hands, but you have something that takes you right back to the beginnings of the art form. And I think that to me is what's so exciting.
Are they also beautifully printed? Is there anything about the editions themselves that's noteworthy?
They're not beautifully printed. I mean, the original, they started engraving them because music, which is in itself an interesting idea, because obviously it was the whole thing of music printing is somewhat more complicated than regular printing, with the notes and the lines and the all little things that you have to the staves. But with the invention of lithography at the end of the 19th century, it became much they switched over from engraving the plates to just drawing them on stone. But that's really a technical thing. But they look, I mean, they're attractive looking, but you wouldn't buy them as aesthetic objects. Although this, you know, this collection has been very beautifully housed. Almost all the scores have been put in leather boxes. So on the shelf, it looks very beautiful. But in themselves, that would be inaccurate to say these are actually aesthetic objects. That they're not ugly objects, but they're not things of beauty.
So the collector, like you, must have been a very profound fan of opera.
Yes, he's semi-professionally involved in music. Has performed in public, but is not a professional musician by calling. But as a music lover, and I find in my contact with music, with the people who have collected music, this is a pretty passionate group. I mean, music lovers tend to be professional. When you find somebody who likes books and music, it's sort of it is a combustible combination.
So he collects this collection over many years.
Right.
And then what happened? Did it come to you? Did he say,
yes.
Peter, I want you to sell this?
Yes, he did, because he said, I reached sort of, A, it's sort of complete. I mean, it's not complete, but he got to the point where, the gap between finding one thing and the next thing was getting longer and longer. I mean, and that's a sort of interesting about some collectors is that they really need, the habit needs to be fed. What have you got to me for today? I need another book. I need something. And when you have, I haven't found anything. It's been 6 months, and I don't know what I'm going to feed the next one. The energy of the collection goes out. I think that's what happened here. The person said, he's no longer young. Obviously, he's been doing this for a long time. So, and I think the one thing he did not want to happen, and we don't want to happen to, is to break it up, because it would be really sad. This thing is, I think we could make more money breaking it up and pricing it individually. It might take a little longer to sell it, but the reality is it's somebody spent a lifetime putting together. You couldn't do it again, so I think it really is important to keep it together, and either with an individual who will then add to it a little bit, or to an institution where it can be used and studied and loved. But to be broken up would be, maybe financially advantageous, would be philosophically be unfortunate.
We're talking to antiquarian book dealer Peter Kraus, owner of Ursus Books. This must be a nice time to do it here in Santa Fe, because there's so many opera people around. I imagine that some of the opera singers themselves can't wait to see some of these objects.
Well, that's right. We've been very fortunate to have this relationship. Edward Borens, who owns Garcia Books, is one of my oldest friends, and we've had this wonderful series of exhibitions every summer, because my first thought when I think of Santa Fe, to be honest with you, is as an art city rather than as a music city. But of course, there is this wonderful opera house, and there is music in Santa Fe, and when this collection sort of arrived here, I thought, it would be a wonderful thing to show it in Santa Fe, because, there is so much opera there, so that it is a sort of logical place to do this.
Do you have institutions or opera? I would think the Metropolitan or other places like that might also be interested. Do you have people who are looking at it?
We've had a couple of people looking at it. I mean, to be realistic about it, the timing is not exactly brilliant. I think there are several people who had their, who would have been interested, but right now their financial commitments are otherwise. But, we're not in a desperate situation here, so we're very patient. So I think the right person or the right institution will come. But
tell us about some of the other music books that you will be showing here in Santa Fe and that are in your collection.
Well, I guess the one thing that Edward is most excited about is which is sort of only tangentially music, but it's just very much related to Santa Fe, is that we have a first edition of The Casuarina Tree by Somerset Maugham, which is one of his more important collections of short stories. And in that collection of short stories, which was published in 1926, is the first edition of The Letter, which then, which I know is an opera, is now an opera, and is going to be premiered at Santa Fe this season. So we have that, and so that's a nice sort of Santa Fe connection. The most exciting thing that we'll have, which is an opera, which is actually not in the collection. I mean, it's a separate thing from the collection, because we have a copy of it in the collection. We have a copy of Wagner's Tannhäuser inscribed by Wagner to Gounod. So to have one of the great operas inscribed by the composer to a composer of one of the other great operas, in bibliophilic terms, that's something that really starts to, you start shaking. I mean, that's really a wonderful thing. Then I guess one of the other things that we have, just to show you that, because music covers such a wide range of things, we have the first edition of The Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin, which is an incredible rarity because it was just a small, 42-page pamphlet, and actually it was considered one of the great treasures in the Morgan Library, and we managed to get a copy, and that's a real find. Then there'll be another sort of interesting musical thing, which is, again, different but wonderful, is that Franz Liszt wrote a book on Chopin. So you have one great composer writing about another, and we have a first edition of that. And then on another opera thing, which is rather amusing, is the Metropolitan Opera published in 1982 an edition of The Rosenkavalier in English, adapted by Anthony Burgess. And we have a copy that's signed by Tatiana Troianis, who sang Octavian at the Met, and Reza Stevens, who also sang Octavian at the Met. So that's kind of nice, operatic connected thing. And then we have a first edition of Stravinsky's Firebird, which, of course, is one of the musical sort of scandal of the 20th century. So there'll be a wide range and then we have a first edition of Mendelssohn's Midsummer Night's Dream. So there'll be a nice range of musical things to show what the possibilities are.
It does make you think about how it was things that became very popular and very great and very important works of music. It wasn't known at the time that that's what was going to happen.
Absolutely.
As you say, a little pamphlet. And it does make you wonder what objects that you might have held in your hand or bought yesterday might be important 50 years from now.
Absolutely. And, of course, I mean, that's one of the things that you know nowadays that people are aware of. People used not to be aware of the concept of, oh, things are going to become collectible and valuable and sought after. But now we're very aware of that. So people do. That's why they all line up outside Barnes & Noble when anybody has a book coming out. I mean, there's a lot of people who collect things now with the possible awareness that something wonderful is going to, you're buying something wonderful and the world will suddenly realize that. I think that's true in the world of art. People are, they go to the studios of the young artists and go to these art fairs and they're trying to, get something that today is maybe just run-of-the-mill, and tomorrow will be considered a masterpiece.
And unless you have a very good eye, it's really just a kind of a crapshoot.
Yeah, well, you have to buy what you like. If you're doing it as a kind of speculative adventure, then I think you're out of your mind, to be honest with you. But if you buy with passion, then you have something that you love, and if you turn out to be right and the world thinks you're a genius in advance of your time, great. But if not, the worst-case scenario is you've had something that you've enjoyed, and that should, at the end of the day, be the most important thing.
And does that works the same way with collectible books and manuscripts?
Absolutely. You've got to love it. You've got to have a passion for it, because just about, we're not a stock market. It's not, and the things aren't, you can't hand them in at the supermarket, and they're not a madly liquid asset, although they're a rather key asset, but they shouldn't be regarded by people as a speculative commodity, I don't think.
It seems like the stuff of certain kinds of mystery novels where something is stolen or something else turns up in an attic, it's sort of intriguing to think about all of these books because, of course, they're so easy to lose. Do you find people coming to you and saying, well, my great-grandmother just died, and in her attic we found a first edition of so-and-so?
Oh, the most bizarre thing, a year ago, a very elegant lady came into my shop with a little shopping bag. So I hope you don't mind. I live around the corner, and my father just died, and I have this little he left these books behind. Would you look at them and tell me if anything, if any of them are worth anything? And I took out, there were 10 really tiny books. Each one would have fit in the palm of the hand. And one of them I sort of recognized. I thought, that looks interesting. I've seen it somewhere. And I looked inside, and in the back, I write a little, every book of mine has an inventory number in the back. And there was my inventory number, and I looked it up on the computer, and the book had been stolen 8 years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
And I looked, checked the other books, and there was actually, my book was quite valuable. It was worth $10,000, but there was a $50,000 book, which was the first book published on an American Indian language in the 17th century, and that was there. And that had been stolen from a friend of mine 8 years ago. So these books found their way home, luckily, but that was a nice event. But they do, you know, little books do tend to go walk about every now and again, because many bibliophiles have sort of combined bibliophilia and kleptomania in the same.
So did you conclude that this woman's father had come into your store
Absolutely.
And stolen your books?
Absolutely, no question.
So what happened then? I mean, did you say, sorry, this is mine, lady?
I did. I said, I'm afraid you're going to have to leave these books here. It was excruciatingly embarrassing. But unfortunately,
wow.
I mean, the owner of the Strand bookstore, that's the sort of New York's greatest and oldest sort of antiquarian bookstore, told me years ago, he said, you never want to know who's stolen books from you, because it's always going to be painful, because it's not some hippie drug addict coming in off the street to feed his habit. It's some well-known bibliophile who, in the heat of the moment, says, you know what, I think I deserve that book more than he does. And people, they steal from institutions and from booksellers and from collectors. I mean, I know collectors who've had books. You know, it's, you know, kleptomania is an unfortunate thing, and books, a lot of book owners somehow rationalize it, that they think that they're the ones that deserve to have the book. The owner isn't worthy of it, and then they just justify it. Because notice that this gentleman that stole the two books I'm talking about, he didn't try and sell them.
Right.
He just wanted to have them.
Did you know him once you put it together? Did you know this man?
I have no clue who it was. No, because the lady, I said, why don't you leave me your name and phone number? And I've got to be in touch with my lawyer and deal with all this. I said, well, you know, I'll call you tomorrow. And, of course, I'm still waiting for the phone call.
Right.
I have no idea. Well, I mean, it was excruciating. I mean, she was more embarrassed than me, poor lady. But
then other books must come in that weren't stolen, but again, were from
right.
some from the trunk in somebody's attic or whatever.
Exactly. No, that's one of the reasons I keep my shop, actually, is because, you know, obviously I have customers who come to look at books, but the shop gives people a chance like that to come in and offer books for sale. And it is amazing over a long period of time what treasures have walked in. I mean, I have to be honest with you, 99 books out of 100 that people bring in are really tragic. You know, they just say, I'm really sorry, it doesn't even worth a while leaving with it. Just leave it and throw it in the waste paper basket. But the one in 100 often is magical. I mean, you do get people who have things. It's very unlikely that you've got a Van Gogh in your attic or a Rembrandt or a Michelangelo, but it's quite possible you have a magical book because, books for so long were not worth anything. And so, you know, people had them and they found them and they gave them away. And it's only recently that so many books have become valuable. So
what makes one book magical and the other one trash?
Well, a good example would be a Bible. You know, I don't want to, you know, slam Bibles, but I say to people, a Bible is an object of, should be an object of devotion and veneration, not an object of commerce. But clearly, many Bibles are beautifully printed and, you know, some are even illustrated, so they become great objects for whatever reason, either from the printing, the binding, the illustration. But, you know, Bibles have been printed ever since the Middle Ages, and there are trillions of them out there. And, you know, certainly in the 19th century, everybody and their brother had a family Bible. And most of them are extremely unattractive. They're badly printed. They're badly bound. They've got bits missing. And they're just old books. And if you have no sentimental attachment to them, which you should have, they have no commercial value whatsoever. I mean, they're just old books. And of course, many old books are incomplete, which also renders them uninteresting from a collectible point of view. And then there's the condition aspect. I mean, if a book is water-stained from the beginning to the end and looks like it's been living in a puddle, it has no commercial possibilities. But, you know, I always think, I mean, so many people look at something, and I think it's, you know, we're in the age of the antique roadshow where people want to know what everything is worth. Well, there are other aspects to life than commerce, and hopefully one has cinema. So you have granny's old cookbook or your great-grandmother's Bible, you know, or a book you had in childhood. It could have no commercial value because you've written all over it or half of it's missing, but it could still have a sentimental value. So I can only ever speak from the point of view of commerce.
I remember when I was a little girl and learned to read, and I liked to read fiction, and especially, you know, children's fiction, right, age appropriate. I would go to the library in the little town where my mother, right, lived, and there would be books, children's books from about 30 or 40 years or 50 years before I was born that were still there. And those, right, things eventually get thrown out. They get, or they, right, deaccessioned or whatever. And those books, I remember even realizing at the time that they gave me an insight about how little girls a generation, oh, yeah, or two ago lived. And those things eventually just go away. So a little girl who's 9 years old now really can't even know how a girl lived in 1940.
Right. Well, and children's books are really one of the great areas of book collecting. And because of what you're saying, I mean, most children's books that children, unfortunately, are not responsible. So they tend to, oh, that's a nice page, I'll tear that one out. Or that's a nice picture, I'll color it with my crayons. Or that's, you know, or they spill their drink on it. Or, you know, so children's books have a very fragile existence. And so the early ones, I mean, you know, there are children's books going back 500 years. They tend to be as a type of book. You know, I've obviously said that opera books are rare, music books are rare, but I think as a type of book, the children's book is probably the rarest kind of book, just because the nature of the beast.
So do you have a specialty, your Ursus Rare books, within book collecting?
Illustrated books, because that gives us a whole range, because, you know, starting in the 15th century, not long after Gutenberg, they started putting pictures in books. And so, the most important early book we've got at the moment is illustrated by Albert Dürer. It was the first thing he worked on. So we have books illustrated from everybody from Dürer right up to Damien Hirst and Hockney and Jasper Johns and contemporary artists who illustrate books. And so you have the whole range of books illustrated by artists. Or, I mean, I sold a cookbook yesterday. It's done by the great French chef Carême. And Carême happened to have been trained as an architect, and he made his cakes, for instance, were architectural creations. I mean, he made cakes and meals that looked as if they were buildings. And so the book is fully illustrated with pictures of his gastronomic creations, but actually it's sort of, you look at it, you're looking at an architecture book. So there's a whole element of illustration that is, you know, every field has illustrated books. It can be medical, it can be children's books, but for us the illustration is one of the things that drives the interest.
And that crosses over into art portfolios and things like that.
Exactly, yeah.
So how much of your business is done through the Internet now?
A surprising amount, because, I mean, today I'm just dealing with an email from Rio de Janeiro. I get emails from all over the world. All our books are on our website. I have a photographer in-house who takes photographs of the inside of the book and the cover. And that's a very, you know, that's one of the changing, I mean, the paradox of the Internet is that on the one hand, it destroys shops because people, so I don't need to go to a shop anymore. I can just sit there and buy online. And on the other hand, it enables me to sit in my shop and sell a book to somebody in Rio de Janeiro. So there is there's always a plus and a minus, and I still haven't figured out which. It's probably more minus than plus, but I'm happy with the plus.
One of the things is, I would imagine that in the pre-internet era, that person would, when he or she came from Rio de Janeiro, you would meet, and all these personal contacts would be made that just don't happen anymore.
Right, and that, you know, that's why I keep my shop, because I can't tell you how many. It's so exciting. You never know who's going to come in, and I'm not going to drop names because it's inappropriate, but I have, over the my sort of 40-plus years in the book trade, I have met the most amazing people that I could never meet as a, you know, otherwise, and so it is. It's a leveling, because it's everybody from, you know, sports stars, movie stars, politicians, presidents, you know, royalty, and you know, I mean, the only name I will drop is one of my early customers. I can't even tell you his name, but he was the, you know, I'm in the Carlisle, and he was an elevator man in the Carlisle, and he loved books. He wasn't madly educated, but he would buy books whenever he found somebody staying in the hotel who he thought had a book connect, who'd written the book or a book about it. He would run out and buy the book and have them sign it. It was nice to have another. And I have one of the waiters in the Carlisle as a collector and a client of mine. So it can be the high and the mighty and the lowly, but you just meet the most interesting people. And the common denominator tends to be a relentless curiosity. And that's what I find tremendously exciting.
Well, the collecting instinct seems to be something that people have, just like they have whatever other gift, like sports or music or whatever it is. And whether they're, I mean, there are people who collect bottle caps, and there are people who collect rare music manuscripts, but it's that same drive somehow.
I think it's very sad. People feel somehow very reassured to be surrounded by things. And if they have some, I mean, obviously you can be like the Collier brothers and just be surrounded by piles of old newspapers, or you can try and have order in it. And I think as human beings, we tend to be orderly, and that's why there is this jigsaw puzzle aspect. I mean, the people like to have a goal and to collect things and then be, you know, physically surrounded by them and mentally have the actual, the two things going on. One is the mental activity of collecting, and then two, then you have the physical reality of being surrounded with them. So it's two things.
What, I mean, you have a bookstore. Do you have your own personal collection?
I always vowed I would never collect because I was competing with my clients. But about a couple of years ago, I decided that it would be amusing to collect wonderful dust jackets on, for by and large, completely insignificant books. Because, you know, great books of the 20th century, I mean, the dust jacket started more or less with the beginning of the 20th century, it's the dust jacket that drives the value. So with the Great Gatsby, for instance, without a dust jacket is not worth very much at all, a few thousand dollars. And with a dust jacket is worth potentially like $150,000 or more. So it's actually the dust jacket that's valuable. So what I thought, there are incredibly attractive and interesting dust jackets on books that absolutely have no redeeming value whatsoever. So I've found about 50 or 60. So when I see books, dust jackets that I find really appealing to me, and then it's not very financially rewarding. I mean, it doesn't cost anything, but it amuses me, and I figure I'm not competing with anybody because nobody other than me is interested in this strange pursuit.
Are you saying that there's dust jackets that exist independent of the books themselves?
No, they come with the book, but the book is absolutely, you know, it can be a book that's absolutely has no value at all. I mean, it's by an author that nobody's ever heard of, or on a subject that nobody's interested in. You know, it can be some history of gloves published in 1927 that nobody's remotely interested in, but has some incredibly abstract design of a glove, or, you know, sort of superimposed on the cover.
What are the favorite objects that have come through your shop in the years that you've been doing this?
I guess one of the all-time favorite objects would have had to been a little volume of tapa cloth. You know, it was the sort of South Seas cloth that they weave in from tree bark in Hawaii and the Pacific that Captain Cook brought back from one of his voyages to the South Seas, and I guess they brought back several large pieces of cloth, and then somebody made a little book about this and put bits of the actual cloth in the book. So I had that about 35 years ago. And then I guess one thing that I've had several times, which is probably my most favorite book, if I wanted it, because I know I can get it. Anyway, I will get it again. It's not unique. Is a Sonia Delaunay did a something called the Prose du Trans-Siberia. It folds out, and it's a colored rendition of a trip that the poet Sondra took from on the Trans-Siberian Railroad, and it's this sort of magical colored scroll that folds out about 10 feet tall, and it's now there are a few dozen copies done. I think I've had three, and I get every decade I get one. And it is a magical object. And the Museum of Modern Art put it on the cover of their big catalog celebrating artist books. So it's a great object.
Do you ever go out scouting for books? Do you find things in yard sales that they're selling for 40 cents that turn out to be worth a lot of money?
I've never done that. I don't troll on eBay. Having started working in really an unimaginably great bookshop, and with somebody who really knew what they were doing, and he taught me that the great things tend to be in great places. And I go to visit my colleagues who have, in Europe, beautiful shops, and I'll find, I'm not looking for the 10,000 book that costs 40 cents. I'd rather get the $10,000 book that costs me 9,000, and I know I'll make 1,000. I mean, the chances of, that's a sort of separate mentality, and I've never really been into that, the sort of trying to find the something that then turns out to be this incredible coup. I mean, I've had a couple in my time, but I think those are largely mythological. The idea that you'll find something that nobody notices and nobody understands what it is somewhere. I mean, I'm sure it happens over time, but it's not a very good business model.
Right. I mean, I think it happens so rarely that when it does, it's big news, and then people think it happens more often.
Yeah.
So these books that are going to be exhibited starting on Friday, the 3rd of July, here at Garcia Street Books in Santa Fe, part of them will be from this opera collection, but they won't be for sale because that collection isn't going to be divided up anytime soon or at all. And then some of them are. I mean, are any of these, if there's some collector here in Santa Fe who wants to buy a book? What are they just there to be bought?
Well, I think so. I mean, they've been, we've had very good luck of having these exhibitions of artist books over the years. They've been, Santa Fe has seemed to produce the, and they haven't all been visitors. I mean, several of them have been actual Santa Fe residents who've collected books. And so, if somebody can buy a book illustrated by Jasper Johns, maybe they'll buy a book written by Richard Wagner. I mean, the possibility is there. And the collection, by the way, is for sale. It's just for sale en bloc. So, but the other books, there will be sort of about two dozen books that will be for sale individually, and the collection will be there, to be bought en bloc, but probably just to be admired, but maybe somebody will fall in love with it and decide they can't live without it.
Peter Kraus is the owner of Ursus Rare Books, and they're on the web at Ursus, U-R-S-U-S, ursusbooks.com. And you can also find them at in New York City, if anybody happens to be traveling to New York City, at 981 Madison Avenue in New York. Peter Kraus, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks so much to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you later. Ciao.